KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
These are considered crimes against humanity and war crimes. The international community must intervene to stop and compel Israel to respect international conventions and the rules of international humanitarian law, which prohibit the targeting of providers of health services and ambulances during war and conflict.
Outrage grows over Israel's killing of 15 Palestinian medics and emergency workers in Gaza. Footage shows ambulances had their lights on when Israeli troops opened fire. Israel initially claimed the convoy had suspiciously approached them in the dark. The medics and ambulances were buried in a mass grave. Amidst protests calling for accountability, we'll speak with Palestinian human rights attorney Diana Bhutu. Her new piece headlined Point Blank Range, How Israel Executed 15 Medics and Rescue Workers in Gaza. Then to the voices of mass protests around the world Saturday as hundreds of thousands told President Trump and billionaire Elon Musk hands off.
I think it's important to speak up. I think silence is not an option. I think you have to stay engaged. You have to stay vigilant. I think it's not only for our community at large, but the world at large.
And we're also demanding the release of the students who have been taken off the streets, abducted, and jailed simply for standing with the Palestinian people.
And we'll look at the impact of Trump's tariffs on heavily indebted countries in the global south. We'll go to New Delhi, India. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Over a million people took to the streets Saturday in the largest protest since President Trump returned to the White House. More than 1,400 demonstrations under the banner of Hands Off took place across all 50 states, as well as in countries across the world. In the United States, organizers said turnout was far higher than expected. Some of the largest protests were held in Washington, D.C., New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Denver, Boston, Philadelphia, and Atlanta. In D.C., speakers included Democratic Congressmember Ilhan Omar of Minnesota.
We are currently living through a president who wants to be a dictator. In America, we do not accept dictators and we do not accept kings. We have a billionaire who has bought a seat next to the president, using him as a puppet. American democracy has never been for sale, and it won't be today.
Anu Gujoshi of American Civil Liberties Union also spoke at the Hands Off rally in Washington.
The unconscionable and unconstitutional arrests of international students and scholars should alarm every one of us. ICE has illegally snatched people from their homes and neighborhoods, threatened their legal status, and sent them across the country with no notice to their loved ones or their lawyers. All of this in direct retaliation for constitutionally protected speech. The government cannot punish us because they don't like what we say.
In Washington, D.C., thousands also took part in a Stop the Genocide rally to protest U.S. support for Israel's war in Gaza. This all came as President Trump spent another weekend golfing in Florida. We'll hear more voices from the protests later in the broadcast. Global stocks are continuing to fall, and fears of a recession are growing after Donald Trump rejected calls to scale back his order to institute sweeping tariffs on most of the world. In Hong Kong, stocks fell today by 13%, the biggest single-day drop since the 1997 Asian financial crisis. Taiwan's main stock index had its worst day since 1990. On Wall Street, $6.6 trillion was wiped out Thursday and Friday. Trump's defending his tariffs plan, telling reporters, quote, sometimes you have to take medicine to fix something, unquote. But there appears to be growing divisions within the Trump administration over the tariff plan. Trump's billionaire advisor, Elon Musk, the world's richest man, says he wants to see the U.S. and Europe have zero tariffs. Musk has also publicly criticized Trump trade advisor Peter Navarro. Another billionaire Trump backer, Bill Ackman, has warned Trump's tariffs could lead to an economic nuclear winter. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. In Gaza, Israel's killed at least 56 Palestinians over the past 24 hours as Israel expands its ground invasion. Overnight, Israel struck a tent housing journalists near Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis. The blast set off a fire that killed two people, including the journalist Helmi Al-Fakawi, who was burned alive. Another journalist, Hassan Eslaya, was seriously wounded in the attack. Meanwhile, outrage is growing over Israel's killing of 15 Palestinian medics and emergency workers in Gaza who were discovered in an unmarked mass grave last week. Footage recovered of the attack show the ambulances in the convoy had their lights on when Israeli troops opened fire. Israel initially claimed the convoy had suspiciously approached the troops with their lights off. On Saturday, the longtime Palestinian politician and Dr. Mustafa Barghouti marched in a protest in Ramallah in the occupied West Bank.
The Israeli army committed a terrible war crime by attacking first aid providers and medics in the Red Crescent Society while they were in their ambulances, clearly marked with their sirens on, with their lights on. Nevertheless, they attacked them and killed them one after the other. And after killing them, and maybe some of them were still wounded, they buried them with sand, they and their ambulances. What the Israeli army did in Rafah, and that's what New York Times have exposed, was a terrible war crime.
In other news from Gaza, health officials are warning at least 600,000 children in Gaza are at risk of permanent paralysis because Israel's barring the entry of polio vaccines to Gaza as part of its broader blockade. According to the UN relief agency UNRWA, Israeli attacks have killed or injured at least 100 children in Gaza every day since Israel broke the ceasefire in mid-March. This comes as President Trump's hosting Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House today. Netanyahu took a longer than usual flight path from Hungary to avoid flying over countries, including Ireland and Iceland, that might enforce an arrest warrant from the International Criminal Court if the plane had to make an emergency landing. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli soldiers have shot dead a 14-year-old Palestinian-American boy named Omar Mohammed Rabia during a raid near the town of Termessiah. Two other Palestinian-American boys, aged 14 and 15, were injured. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry condemned what it called the extrajudicial killing of the boy, who is a U.S. citizen. Israel acknowledged shooting the boys, who they accused of throwing rocks. Meanwhile, Reuters is reporting the Trump administration's moving forward with a plan to send 20,000 assault rifles to Israel. The Biden administration had paused the shipment out of fear the guns could end up in the hands of violent Israeli settlers. The UK's foreign secretary condemned Israel's refusal to allow entry to two members of the British Parliament as, quote, unacceptable, counterproductive, and deeply concerning, unquote. The two Labour lawmakers, Yuen Yang and Abtissam Mohammed, arrived back in London after being deported from Israel on Sunday. They've been planning to visit aid projects in the occupied West Bank as part of a British parliamentary delegation. Israel accused the lawmakers of planning to document Israeli security forces and supporting boycotts and sanctions against Israel and Israeli officials. In Burma, which is also known as Myanmar, heavy rains and winds this week are expected to disrupt rescue and relief operations as many people continue to sleep in open air after losing their homes in the March 28th earthquake. The death toll has topped 3,500 people. Over 5,000 have been injured. In Mandalay, residents say they're still awaiting assistance from the military government after our areas were wiped out by a fire that was triggered by the earthquake.
The fireball emerged from the ground immediately just after the earthquake. It was a big fire. There were barely minutes between the earthquake and the fire. The fire spread out across the district and wiped out all 400 houses. Everybody ran away and now nothing remains. We are in deep trouble.
Meanwhile, the Trump administration reportedly fired the three USAID officials it sent to Burma following the earthquake while they were in Mandalay to assess the situation. It's part of President Trump and Elon Musk's plan to completely dismantle USAID. A Russian attack on Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's hometown of Kryvyi Rih killed at least 19 people, including 9 children, including some who were at a playground. Over 70 people were injured. The UN's top human rights official, Volker Türk, condemned what he called Russia's, quote, reckless disregard for civil life, unquote. The Russian Defense Ministry claimed the strike targeted a meeting of unit commanders and Western instructors. Zelensky criticized Russia again for not agreeing to an unconditional ceasefire.
Ukraine has accepted the American proposal, the proposal of a full unconditional ceasefire. Putin has rejected it. We are waiting for the U.S. reaction. So far, there has been none.
In the Democratic Republic of the Congo, severe flooding has killed at least 33 people in the capital, Kinshasa, destroyed homes and roads. This comes as the east of the country suffering worsening security and humanitarian crises as M23 fighters have advanced in north and south Kivu provinces. Some 7,000 people have been killed. Millions have been forced to flee their homes in recent months. A Trump administration official said last week the U.S. and the DRC are nearing a deal that would allow U.S. companies to exploit Congo's reserves of valuable minerals, including cobalt and lithium, in exchange for providing security. The U.S. is continuing to carry out airstrikes on Yemen. On Sunday, Yemeni health officials said at least 4 people were killed in a U.S. strike on a home in Sana'a. More than 20 people were injured, including women and children. Meanwhile, President Trump posted a video online of an earlier U.S. strike in Yemen. The video shows a blast hitting over 70 people standing in an oval formation. Trump claimed the people targeted were Houthis preparing to carry out an attack. But according to reports in Yemen, the blast actually hit a tribal gathering to celebrate Eid al-Fitr, the end of Ramadan. The Trump administration's launched near-daily attacks on Yemen since mid-March, when the Houthis resumed attacks on ships in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden in solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza. A federal judge has accused the Trump administration of committing a grievous error that shocks the conscience by expelling Kilmer Abrego Garcia, a Maryland father, to a notorious prison in El Salvador, even though the man was under a court order not to be sent back to El Salvador. In a ruling on Sunday, federal judge Polichinis wrote, quote, defendant seized Abrego Garcia without any lawful authority, held him in 3 separate domestic detention centers without legal basis, failed to present him to any immigration judge or officer, and forcibly transported him to El Salvador in direct contravention of the Immigration and Nationality Act, unquote. Judge Chinas has ordered the Trump administration to bring him back by midnight tonight. On Friday, Abrego Garcia's wife, Jennifer Vasquez Sudas, spoke briefly to the press in Maryland.
I want to say thank you to everyone that has helped us, that has supported us in fighting this, and we will continue fighting for Kilmer, for my husband. Thank you.
The Trump administration is now claiming there's nothing it can do to bring Kilmer Abrego Garcia back home. Meanwhile, the Justice Department has placed a senior immigration lawyer on indefinite leave after he acknowledged in court Friday the Trump administration had made a mistake in sending Abrego Garcia back to El Salvador. The lawyer, Erez Riveni, had worked for the Justice Department for 15 years. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says the U.S. is revoking all visas held by South Sudanese nationals in response to the government of South Sudan not accepting citizens recently removed from the U.S. The U.S. will also stop issuing visas for South Sudanese passport holders. A number of citizens of South Sudan are currently in the U.S. under temporary protected status, but this is set to expire May 3rd. This comes as many fear South Sudan may on the cusp of a new civil war as a power-sharing deal between government rivals recently collapsed, and the first president, Riek Machar, remains under house arrest. In other immigration news, a Chinese woman has died by suicide at a Border Patrol station in Yuma, Arizona, after she was detained for overstaying her visa. Democratic Congressmember Pramila Jayapal of Washington blasted the Border Patrol amidst reports the agents failed to conduct welfare checks on the woman. The Trump administration's escalating its targeting of international university students in recent days. U.S. Department of Homeland Security revoked visas for a number of students and recent graduates at the University of Michigan, University of California, Berkeley, Stanford, UMass Amherst, Harvard, Arizona State University, Colorado State University, and the University of Colorado and other schools. Meanwhile, the Trump administration is threatening to pause $510 million in federal funding from Brown University. Days of major storms and flooding have killed at least 18 people across southern and midwestern U.S. states, with the highest number of deaths recorded in Tennessee. Other hard-hit states include Kentucky, Arkansas, Ohio, Missouri, Mississippi, and Alabama. The deadly storms come as the National Weather Service has become severely understaffed following cuts by the Trump administration. In environmental news, on Thursday, the Trump administration removed federal protections for over half the land managed by the U.S. Forest Service, opening vast areas up to logging. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. attended the West Texas funeral Sunday of an 8-year-old girl who died of measles. She was not vaccinated and is the second known measles death in Texas amid the current outbreak. Texas has reported over 480 cases, many of them affecting members of the Mennonite community, which has lower rates of vaccination than the general public. During his visit to the epicenter of the outbreak, RFK Jr. posted on social media, quote, "The most effective way to prevent the spread of measles is the MMR vaccine," unquote. It's his most direct comments on the vaccine yet, even as he continues to also promote unproven treatments, including vitamin A. And the director of the National Museum of African American History and Culture left his post Friday. Kevin Young had led the groundbreaking Washington, D.C. institution since 2021 and comes amidst Trump's campaign to completely overhaul the Smithsonian and its landmark museums and cultural institutions. Last month, Trump issued an executive order accusing the Smithsonian of promoting a, quote, divisive, race-centered ideology. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. For the second time since January, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is in Washington, D.C. today to meet with President Trump as Israel expands its ground invasion of Gaza. According to the UN relief agency, UNRWA, Israeli attacks have killed or injured at least 100 children in Gaza every day since Israel broke the ceasefire in mid-March. This comes as Israel has killed at least 56 Palestinians over the past 24 hours. Overnight, Israel struck a tent housing journalists near Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis. The blast set off a fire that killed two people, including the journalist Helmi Al-Fakawi, who was burned alive. Another journalist, Hassan Eslaya, was seriously wounded in the attack. Meanwhile, outrage is growing over Israel's killing of 15 Palestinian medics and emergency workers in Gaza who were discovered in an unmarked mass grave last week. Footage recovered of the attack shows the ambulances in the convoy had their lights on when Israeli troops opened fire. Israel had initially claimed the convoy had suspiciously approached the troops with their lights off. Cell phone video of Israel's attack was recorded by a paramedic who was inside the vehicle when it came under fire, was among the 15 aid workers who were killed. That's the sound of gunfire from Israeli soldiers. An Israeli military spokesperson said in a statement that its troops, quote, did not randomly attack an ambulance on March 23rd, and that, quote, following an initial assessment, it was determined the forces had eliminated Hamas military operative Ibrahim Shubaki, who took part in the October 7th massacre, along with eight other terrorists from Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, they said. Well, on Saturday, The longtime Palestinian politician and doctor Mustafa Barghouti marched in a protest in Ramallah.
The Israeli army committed a terrible war crime by attacking first aid providers and medics in the Red Crescent Society while they were in their ambulances, clearly marked with their sirens on, with their lights on. Nevertheless, they attacked them and killed them one after the other. And after killing them, and maybe some of them were still wounded, they buried them with sand, they and their ambulances. What the Israeli army did in Rafah, and that's what New York Times have exposed, was a terrible war crime.
The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said the people were buried in a mass grave, with the ambulance also buried. Some of their bodies were found with their hands or legs tied and had gunshot wounds to the head and chest. This is Palestine Red Crescent Society Media Director Raed Elnams addressing reporters Sunday.
These are considered crimes against humanity and war crimes. The international community must intervene to stop and compel Israel to respect international conventions and the rules of international humanitarian law, which prohibit the targeting of providers of health services and ambulances during war and conflict.
For more, we're joined by Diana Bhutu, longtime Palestinian human rights attorney, former advisor to the negotiating team of the Palestine Liberation Organization. She has a new piece in Zateo headlined Point Blank Range, How Israel Executed 15 Medics and Rescue Workers in Gaza. Diana, welcome back to Democracy Now! Thanks for joining us from Haifa. If you can start off by giving us the chronology of what happened to the medics and the paramedics and the ambulance drivers, and what Israel first said, and then when the footage was taken from the cell phone of a dead paramedic, what then Israel has responded?
Well, what we know, Amy, is that the Israeli army attacked an area in Rafah, a neighborhood in Rafah, Tel el-Sultan. And as has been the case over the course of the past year and a half, today marks a year and a half of this genocide, paramedics, Palestinian paramedics, went out to try to rescue people who were there, as well as to try to give them some medical services. As has been the case from the beginning, the paramedics notified and gave word that they were heading out. They had their lights on, as they've always had their lights on. And nonetheless, what we do know is that the Israeli army then attacked the ambulances that were going there. Not just attacked these ambulances, but then shot at these individuals point blank range. Many of them were actually found with their hands and their feet bound, and several of them were found with more than 20 gunshot wounds to the head and to the chest. To make matters then worse, we then have a group of soldiers who then decide that they're going to bury these ambulances. And so they dug up a mass grave and buried the ambulances in this mass grave. It took several days to be able to find these paramedics because they had gone missing and nobody was able to find them before people were then able to uncover them and the ambulances. Now, of course, as is always the case, Israel always claims that, oops, we didn't do it. Then they deflect and say, oh, it happened to be somebody who was wanted. And of course, both of these are against the rules of international law. But then only when it became clear that there was footage of that the paramedics had done everything right, that we now hear that the Israelis are now claiming that they buried the ambulance, get this, Amy, in order to prevent the people from being eaten by wild animals. In other words, what they have done time and again is be able to get away with point blank executions, with carrying out digging up mass graves and committing these war crimes. And all that they have to say time and again is, oops, sorry, and nobody is holding them to account. We now have over 409 medics who have been killed by Israel over the course of the past 18 months. There have been scores who are still remaining in prison, many of them being tortured. All of these are attacks against the medical system, and this is deliberate, and it's happening because nobody is stopping Israel.
I mean, It's very interesting that the Times of Israel said that the army defended burying the bodies in an unmarked grave, claiming this is an approved and regular practice during fighting in Gaza, and as you pointed out, to prevent the animals. But it's a standard practice to bury people in graves. And that, why the ambulances buried all evidence they tried to cover up?
Yes, and this is the problem, Amy, is that you have to think about the levels of criminality, the level of dehumanization that it takes for not just one, but several of these soldiers to be able to think through and say, one, we're going to shoot at ambulances. Two, we're going to tie them up. Three, we're going to execute them. And then four, we're going to bury them as well as the ambulances. It's such the height of dehumanization. And because nobody's holding Israel to account, they continue to get away with it.
Why is Prime Minister Netanyahu in Washington today for a second time? He talked about where he's going to be talking about tariffs on Israel and other issues. But why do you think?
I think it's for two reasons. One is I think he's trying to get even more weapons to be sent to Israel. And second is I think he really wants to cement the Trump plan of ethnic cleansing, this plan that was unveiled back in January of this year. And I say this because Netanyahu has made it clear since he broke the ceasefire on March the 18th, precisely what it is that he wants to do. He's been saying time and again that he intends to go after all of Gaza, and he's made it clear that he's been doing so, but that he intends to implement the Trump plan. And so I think he's looking for additional backing by this administration in order to carry out this plan. And the only way that he will be able to ethnically cleanse 2 million people from the Gaza Strip is through the use of mass weaponry and through the pressure, the diplomatic pressure that the United States will undoubtedly bring to bear against Palestinians and, of course, against the rest of the Arab world. It's clear what Netanyahu wants to do. The question becomes whether anybody is going to stop him.
I wanted to get your response, Diana Bhutu, to what happened overnight. Israel striking a tent housing journalists near Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis. The video is horrifying. The blast sets up this fire, and you see a journalist, Helmi Al-Fakhawi, who's sitting in a chair burning alive as other journalists tried to rescue him. Another journalist was seriously wounded in the attack. This was a tent of journalists. Your response?
What Israel's been trying to do is to kill anybody who's continuing to bear witness and to bring to light Israel's crimes. This is why we've now seen that this is 211 journalists that Israel has killed. More journalists have been killed in Gaza than in any other place around the world. This is why they're going after medics. This is why they're going after the United Nations. This is why they're going after individual civilians as well, is that they want to make sure that they continue to carry out this genocide without anybody reporting on it. And the fact that we haven't seen global outrage over over this mass killing of journalists and the mass killing of medics and of UN workers and so on just shows the height of dehumanization. It's high time that people wake up and realize that Israel's doing this for a reason, and they continue to get away with it because nobody is stopping them.
I want to also ask you about what happened in the occupied West Bank. Israeli soldiers shooting dead a 14-year-old Palestinian-American boy named Omar Mohammed Rabia during a raid of the town of Termessiah. Two other Palestinian-American boys, 14 and 15, were injured. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry condemned what it called the extrajudicial killing. Israel acknowledged shooting the boys. They accused them of rock throwing. Diana Bhutu.
Yeah. Yes, this is, again, another example, Amy, of the levels of dehumanization and the fact that Israeli soldiers are given orders of shoot to kill. I don't think that that we should be living in a world in which 13, 14, 15-year-old children are condemned to death because they're trying to resist military occupation through a stone. And yet these are the instructions and the orders that the Israeli army has given to its soldiers, which is shoot and kill, and we will then provide cover for you forever. This is why we've never seen any Israeli soldiers be held to account for the killings of children, for the killings of journalists, for the killings of medics, and so on.
And then you have the situation of health officials saying 600,000 children in Gaza are at risk of permanent paralysis because Israel's barring the entry of polio vaccines to Gaza as part of its broader overall blockade. And according to UNRWA, Israeli attacks have killed or injured 100 children a day since Israel broke the ceasefire. Deanna Bhutu, there were protests all over the country, including those protesting around Israel's war on Gaza and U.S. support for that war. Thousands marched in Washington in a separate protest outside the hands-off protest, and many joined the hands-off protest who felt this way. What do you think of the U.S. role and what the U.S. can do as Netanyahu meets with Trump?
The U.S. has been complicit, and it's been Israel's largest supplier. This isn't just an Israeli genocide against Palestinians. This is a U.S.-backed Israeli genocide against Palestinians. And the important part of this is that if you look at who makes up the Palestinian people, particularly in Gaza, more than 50% are children. More than 50% are under the age of 18. And when people talk about genocide, I think the element that is largely ignored is that we're not just talking about the number of people who are killed or the number of people who are injured. It's about the specific intent to try to kill off a group of people. When you deny them health care, when you deny them the ability to have access to medicine, as we're seeing with the polio vaccine, as we're seeing with the bombing of all 36 hospitals in the Gaza Strip, you can see the specific intent to commit and carry out genocide, to eliminate an entire group. And it's now the children who are in the Israel's target. They're the ones who are in Israel's crosshairs, as they always have been. The things that can be specifically done are to make sure that that weapon supply does not make it to Israel. Without U.S. weaponry, the Israeli army cannot continue its attack on Gaza to this same extent. We also have to be pushing to make sure that Israel is ostracized and that the international mechanisms are in place to make sure that people are held to account. Without this, we can just see that what the next steps are going to be, and Netanyahu has made it clear. He wants to get rid of Palestinians. He's made it clear that he wants to see ethnic cleansing, and he's made it clear that he wants to see genocide. And it's up to us to be doing everything to stop it.
So we only have a minute, but I wanted to ask you about this last question. Netanyahu went to Hungary to meet with Orban, and so Hungary pulled out of the International Criminal Court so it wouldn't have to arrest him. There's an ICC warrant for him for war crimes and crimes against humanity. When Netanyahu flew from Hungary to the United States, he took a longer than usual flight path to avoid flying over countries, including Ireland and Iceland, that might enforce an arrest warrant from the International Criminal Court if the plane had to make an emergency landing. The significance of this?
The significance of this is that the places in which Netanyahu is able to go are getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And it's just a question of time before we begin to see a global alliance to make sure that this war criminal is held to account. He's made it clear that he wants to inflict genocide. He's made the policies of starvation clear. There's been nothing entering Gaza since March the 2nd. And this this space for him to be able to travel is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. I believe it's just a question of time before the system catches up to him. At least I hope it is.
Deanna Bhutu, Palestinian human rights attorney, former advisor to the negotiating team of the Palestine Liberation Organization. We'll link to your piece in Zateo, Point Blank Range, How Israel Executed 15 Medics and Rescue Workers in Gaza. When we come back, voices of the mass protests around the world, over a million marched, telling President Trump and billionaire Elon Musk, hands off.
So. Femme du Mali, la femme africaine, femme du monde, je vous salue tous les jours. Femme du Mali, la femme africaine, les femmes du monde, je vous salue tous les jours. Vous travaillez sans relâche. Si vous allez dans les sentiers, vous allez voir des femmes. Si vous allez dans les usines.
Femmes du monde, Women of the World by Amadou and Mariam. In 2018, in our Democracy Now! Studio, the Malian guitarist and singer Amadou Bagayoko died last week at the age of 70. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We look now at the massive protests that erupted Saturday as over a million people took to the streets nationwide to tell President Trump and billionaire Elon Musk hands off, saying no to the Trump administration's dismantling of federal agencies and social programs and its attacks on LGBTQ people, immigrants, education, healthcare, science, free speech, and reproductive rights. The coordinated hands-off protests are the largest demonstrations since President Trump returned to office. They took place across all 50 states and across the world. In Europe, thousands gathered in Berlin, Paris, and London to respond to Trump's sweeping tariffs, which have shocked the global economy. This is a banker speaking from London.
He's a horrible, small-minded person who is easily maneuvered. And the people who are maneuvering him are very, very, very dangerous. And he's very dangerous, but he's a small-minded and not, frankly, very smart person. So, no, I just hope this is over soon.
Thousands also took to the streets across Canada to protest Trump's repeated threats of making Canada the 51st U.S. state. Demonstrators condemned Trump's remarks as a threat to Canadian sovereignty. This is a Vancouver protester.
Today, I'm out here to send a simple, clear message to the United States that we're not going to want to be a part of you. We're never going to want to be a part of you. This is very close to becoming a reality down there. Right now, we have our very own election, which is extremely scary with what we're seeing as being the unsaid messages from one side. And I'm here as a visual reminder to let people know that we're not going to let this happen. We are not going to sit quietly.
In the United States, there are over 1,200 protests, like this one in Los Angeles.
Well, I've marched before when he first got elected a number of years ago, and I still can't believe that he got elected again. And I can't believe that he's tanking the economy and he's tanking the government, and it's all being done for him and for Elon Musk and all the billionaires and everybody else. It's not for me. It's not for the people who live in my neighborhood. It's for all of these billionaires. And I'm glad to see so many people came out today. I mean, we need it. I want more people to show up and get him out of office. He's
there
terrible.
There were over 20 protests across the state of Colorado, like this one in Denver in the freezing cold, including former and current workers.
My name is Marina Connors, and this one says, hands off public lands. I'm a retired National Park Service employee, and it's kind of, it's really hard to run the parks, and to do it under these circumstances is even more and more difficult.
I am a federal employee today, and hope that I can stay that. Hope that I can stay employed so that I can continue to serve the American people who I swore to serve when I took my oath of office.
That federal worker covered her face, but her sign said, with her sign, it said, I want DEI in schools, not measles. Protesters estimated to be in the tens of thousands gathered in Washington, D.C. in mass opposition to Trump's policies. A sea of banners and placards filled the Washington Mall, including signs that read, resist like it's 1938 Nazi Germany and fascism alive and well and living in the White House. Speakers included Congressmembers Ilhan Omar and Jamie Raskin.
They say, though, well, the number of courts striking down Trump's policies is completely unprecedented. Well, so what? That's only because the number of his illegal actions are completely unprecedented. The judges are doing their jobs. They're doing their jobs. Let's tell MAGA what democratic movements all over the world tell the dictators of the world. Hands off the courts. Hands off the courts.
Meanwhile, another protest Saturday in D.C. demanded an arms embargo against Israel and an end to the Gaza genocide and the release of Mahmoud Khalil, Rumeysa Öztürk, and other foreign university students and faculty who remain in ICE detention, targeted for their involvement in Palestinian rights protests. This is Mohammed Habeh from the American Muslims for Palestine.
I'm here today because for the past year and a half, we have seen the utter destruction going on in Gaza funded by American taxpayer dollars. We've seen it in the previous administration, and we see now that Donald Trump is continuing and making it worse for the people in Gaza. After a month of fasting in the month of Ramadan, we saw that the people in Gaza were suffering a famine, as well as seeing Israel break the ceasefire and begin massacring Palestinians throughout the month and on the day of Eid. I'm here today because I want the people of Gaza to see that the American people will not accept this, that the American people will stand up against our government as they continue to support this genocide.
My name is Eugene Perrier. I'm with the Answer Coalition, and we're demanding the immediate end of the genocide in Gaza. The U.S. should stop all of its forms of complicity and facilitation of that genocide and do everything in its power to bring it to an end immediately. And we're also demanding the release of the students who have been taken off the streets, abducted, and jailed simply for standing with the Palestinian people, and for all those who have been repressed because of the steps they've taken to stand up for the right of self-determination and liberation of Palestine, to have all charges, all lawsuits, or anything like that dropped, and allow people to speak up and speak out against this genocide.
And here in New York City, up to 100,000 people took to the streets in Manhattan, marching from Bryant Park to Madison Square Park. Democracy Now! Was there. There were many issues discussed, among them Rumeysa Öztürk, that tough student who was sent to Louisiana after being driven to Vermont, picked off the streets of Somerville, Massachusetts, by masked agents. A judge has ruled her case has to be sent back to Vermont. These were some of the voices.
My name is Sarah. I'm not with the group. I went to Tufts University, and that is where Rumeysa Öztürk was disappeared from. And she is owed due process and a chance to continue her education, and she was here legally, and it should never be considered illegal to write an op-ed. Whether you agree or disagree with what she said, it's her right, and I just want her to be free, and I want that for all the people who have been disappeared by the Trump administration.
Is the Tufts community active on Rumeysa's case?
Yes. So I know the president sent out an email the other day. The university is standing with Rumeysa and her lawyer. And also, many of my fellow alum have stood up, signed letters, and taken action to free Rumeysa and get justice for her.
Christine Harrington, and I'm with lots of friends, and I'm a professor at NYU. And
what do you teach?
I teach law and politics, so I watched you.
What do you think is happening to the universities?
There are, you know, some of them are caving, and the first ones are caving. Not so good. Not so good at all. But that's why we're out here.
What do you think the universities should do?
Fight back. Make it clear, this is unacceptable. It has never happened, and it will not happen. I mean, to mobilize together. But the caving we saw starting with Columbia and the spread has just made some universities figure duck and cover, you know? We'll get through this. That's not what universities should be about.
My name
is Janine Georgette. I can't believe I'm still have to protest this because I can't believe it. I mean, I've been out protesting since I was about 5. It was the first time I remember holding a sign. That we are so under attack. Our country is being torn down. I don't really know why. Like, I don't get what they get from tearing our country apart. But they're pulling it down. And so I'm out here to try to keep it upright.
What does the other side say?
Payback is a bitch, and she votes.
Do you think a protest like this of tens of thousands of people can make a difference?
You know, I saw it make a difference in the Vietnam War. When so many people get together like this, politicians notice. And so, yes, the protests around the Vietnam War stopped it. There's no doubt in my mind. And so this kind of activism, they notice. They take note.
My sign says, stop the mass kidnappings with no due process. Dictator wannabe and felon Donald Trump. I'm just very upset about him taking these people and sending them to El Salvador without any due process. He says that it's because they are from Tren de Aragua, but he didn't prove this. He didn't give any of these people a chance, an opportunity to say whether they're from that gang or not. That to me is just BS. He's even defying the judge's orders, even during appeal. That is just BS, and we can't stand for that.
I'm a probationary worker at the NIH. I'm a staff scientist.
All probationary workers weren't fired?
All probation, no, they weren't fired. But a good 40% or so were fired, so I don't know the exact number.
And what does your sign say?
We just need to fund science and stop the cuts and stop funding billionaires and stop going for their actual purposes. We want to, you know, really re-educate the population. We need more funding in science. You know, new epidemics are going to start coming out unless we actually start putting more investment in research and more investment in public health.
I'm Rabbi Bara Ellman. I'm out here because we're on the break. We have to stand up against this encroaching authoritarianism and fascism. And I'm definitely scared for democracy. And we have to be in the streets, not just this week, but every week.
How do you feel about President Trump going after universities in the name of combating anti-Semitism?
I am so distressed and angry about that. His weaponization of anti-Semitism is going to make Jews, is going to be dangerous for Jews, but also it's such a cynical use of this idea, which from his cabinet, which has so many people whose anti-Semitism is widely demonstrated, for him to then try to claim that he's arguing on our behalf. And it's also so completely, blatantly false. You know, to someone protesting the war in Gaza is not endangering myself as a Jew. And frankly, I also think the whole portrayal of the safety issue on campuses for Jews has been widely represented, and failing to talk about, you know, the safety of Muslims and Palestinians on campus. So I'm a rabbi, and I'm a very active Jewish, very active as a Jew, and frankly, his weaponization of this, of anti-Semitism, I find grotesque and scary and wrong.
My name is Isaac. I made this sign to say 1825. It's because everything that we have made, 200 years of progress since 1864, is being taken away. They already went after women's rights. They already went after Latino rights. They ain't gonna stop until they come after everybody, until we get thrown back to 19th century America again. Need I say more?
What's your name? What's your sign, and why are you here?
My name is Susan. I'm here because this man is not fit to be president. President doesn't tell people to digest bleach and die in parking lots instead of getting health care, instead of getting lunch, instead of defending our allies in Europe, defending democracy in the world.
What does your sign say?
My sign says no more tariffs, no kings, and no third terms. This is not how our president behaves.
Voices from the hands-off protest in New York City. Estimates are up to 100,000 people marched on Saturday in the rain, some of the million who marched around the globe. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we look at the impact of Trump's tariffs on heavily indebted countries in the global south. Back in 20 seconds.
So. Bofu zafu, kanage bofu zafu, ye diye kona. Bofu zafu, anganage bofu zafu, ye diye kona. Bofu zafu, kanage bofu zafu, ye enteri.
Bofu zafu by Amadou and Mariam in our 2018 interview at Democracy Now! Studios. Malian guitarist and singer Amadou Bagayoko died last week at the age of 70. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Global stocks are continuing to fall. Fears of recession are growing after President Trump rejected calls to scale back his order to institute sweeping tariffs on most of the world. And Hong Kong stocks fell today by 13%, biggest single-day drop since 1997 Asian financial crisis. Taiwan's main stock index had its worst day since 1990. On Wall Street, $6.6 trillion was wiped out on Thursday and Friday. Trump's defending his tariff plan, telling reporters, quote, sometimes you have to take medicine to fix something, unquote. But there appears to be growing divisions within the Trump administration over the tariffs plan. Trump's billionaire advisor, Elon Musk, the world's richest man, says he wants to see the U.S. and Europe have zero tariffs. Musk has also publicly criticized Trump trade advisor Peter Navarro. Another billionaire Trump backer, Bill Ackman, was warning that Trump's tariffs could lead to an economic nuclear winter. For more on the impact of these tariffs, especially on the poorest countries of the world, we're joined by Jayati Ghosh, economics professor at University of Massachusetts Amherst. She was previously an economics professor at Jawaharlal Nehru University in New Delhi, India, where she taught for 35 years. She's joining us now from Delhi, from India. Professor, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you lay out what is the effect of the tariffs as you see them on the poorest countries of the world?
Well, I think what's really striking about this whole tariff policy is not just the sheer stupidity of it, which I think you've already highlighted, the impact that is taking place in the rich countries, but the fact, the wanton cruelty of it. Because the formula that's used is bizarre. It has nothing to do with the actual kind of protection that these countries afford themselves. But many of them are really the poorest, most debt-stressed, most climate-impacted countries in the world. And to actually attack them in this completely unnecessary way is quite unbelievable. In my own region in South Asia, we have Sri Lanka. I've just come back from Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Pakistan, which are facing very, very high tariff rates. They are all struggling with massive debt burdens. They can barely generate enough foreign exchange to import the most essential items. They, on top of that, have to pay very, very heavy debt service, and they've not really managed significant restructuring. All of them are under IMF programs. And yet you get then this completely unnecessary, wanton kind of attack on a little bit of foreign exchange that they're generating. So, because the U.S. is a major market for all of them.
So you have what some are calling Trump's shock and awe trade policy, the imposition of punitive tariffs on developing countries where you are across Asia, like 49% on Cambodia, 37% on Bangladesh, 48% for Laos. What exactly does this mean on their end in these countries, and what it means for people in the United States when those tariffs are imposed?
Well, let's take Bangladesh, Laos, Cambodia, Sri Lanka. They are dominantly garment exporters. Now, this is a sort of labor-intensive activity that typically developing countries take up at the early stage of their development. It's not going to shift to the U.S., and in fact, the U.S. doesn't want those jobs. So the whole idea that you will somehow attack these countries for just a little bit of very labor-intensive export that they must generate because they're all facing very severe crises of the other kinds that I mentioned, is really strange. Now, garments are not just a significant export and source of foreign exchange, but they are major employers, and particularly of women. So what we're going to see now are significant layoffs. We've already seen people in Sri Lanka and companies in Bangladesh complaining that orders have stopped already, even before the tariffs actually come into effect, and that they're going to actually have to lay off hundreds of thousands of workers, in some cases, possibly millions of workers. And what that will do to economies that are already reeling under severe crisis. In Bangladesh, you've already had political upheaval. In Sri Lanka, you have a new government after significant political upheaval. What that will do to all of these countries is actually quite terrifying.
Why do you think President Trump is imposing these, given this isn't a situation where it hurts other countries, but it really benefits the United States? I mean, he wasn't explaining this weekend. He was out golfing.
Well, I mean, it's because there is no explanation. We now know what the formula is. It's this completely ridiculous formula. The trade deficit the U.S. has with that country divided by the U.S. imports from that country divided by half. That's nothing, right? So the maximum you could possibly impose is 50%. Some countries have got close to that, 48-49%, like Cambodia, like Vietnam, which is ridiculous because these are tiny, tiny amounts. For the US, it's not even a drop in the ocean of their imports. But because they have simply applied this across the board for all countries, somebody said that basically they obviously just asked ChatGPT or something to work this out without thinking about the context or even what they want strategically from this. Because they just applied this across the board, all kinds of countries in Africa, in Latin America, in Asia are going to be suffering hugely. And that chaos is going to come even to countries that are not directly affected by very high tariffs. So even countries that are facing, let's say, only 10% tariff, like Nepal, or other countries that have got away with slightly lower rates, 20%, 25%, and still high, but lower, are still going to actually face the fallout of this because there is likely to be a global recession. There is already so much uncertainty that people are canceling orders, companies are reducing investment plans. We've seen what's happened to the stock market, we've seen what's happened to oil price. These are all indicators that there is likely to be a dramatic global slowdown and recession. Now, that affects everybody. That affects even countries that didn't get a major tariff hit. And so all countries in the world, and particularly, as I mentioned, the poorest countries who have a lot of difficulty generating dollars, are going to actually face a really major shock, which is completely man-made and unnecessary.
And can you talk about how this will impact workers, people around the world who work for U.S. companies?
Oh, absolutely. It's not just the U.S. companies, it's the companies that U.S. companies, you know, there are these value chains. So all of the major garment producers, for example, are multinationals who outsource to local companies. All of them are being hit. But it's not just that. It's going to affect the supply chains in electronics. It's going to affect the supply chains in a lot of the new machinery that is essential for, let's say, the cars that Elon Musk wants to build and so on. So, in fact, this is also going to come back to bite the United States.
And the U.S. ultimately putting tariffs on China of over 50% and then China retaliating with over 30% tariffs in this last minute.
I think what's really significant about the Chinese response is not just the tariff response, but the fact that they have put export bans on some critical raw materials of which they are currently the only global producer. And that's going to affect all kinds of production, all of the new high technology production that the U.S. wants to encourage, and where it feels that it wants to gain a technological advantage over China, simply won't happen. Everything from EVs to solar panels to you name it, defense equipment, etc., all of this is going to be affected. So it's been a remarkably stupid strategic move by Trump. No, I just wanted to say that there's a silver lining in this for developing countries, which is that for too long, for maybe three decades, we've been told that the only way we can develop is through export-led growth. And that's really, it's been unfortunate because we have never seen giving our own workers a fair deal as a good option. We've always seen wages as a cost, not as a source of our own domestic demand and market. It's now time to actually change, to shift gears, to think about different trading arrangements, more regional arrangements, looking at other developing countries as markets, looking at our own